is an 8-iron, and it's a dead shank.
Wow.
Way right.
Oh, takes a hop off the path.
You gotta be kidding me.
Very tough pitch shot right here. You gotta hit it into the hill. One hop up and bite, and it's in.
Kind of like that!
Hey, everybody. This is Jay from Sub70. It is Friday afternoon, getting a little work done here, also watching the Genesis Open on PGA Tour Live. Awesome leaderboard right now. Patrick Cantlay is winning, Ryan Moore is one back, Tony Finau, Dominic Bazzelli, Bubba Watson, Jamie Lovemark, Ches Reavy, who's been on the leaderboard for the last month and a half, it seems like, and a couple of young guys like Aaron Wise, and so it should be a good weekend. Definitely rooting for Cantlay. Got one of the better looking swings on tour and has been through some stuff, and I definitely would like to see him get another victory. This episode of the podcast is our interview with Ken Green. Ken Green has a very interesting golf story. He's a five-time PGA Tour winner. He also played in the 1989 Ryder Cup. He grew up in Honduras, was basically given the option of playing either golf or soccer, and being American, he said, I'll go play golf, and left home to pursue his dream of being a professional golfer. Moved to Florida, actually played college golf with Calc at Florida, and then was on the tour for quite a long time and had a very successful career. He has some hilarious stories, some hilarious experiences. He's very honest, and we certainly appreciate the time and the interview. So thanks to Ken. Highly, highly recommend checking this out. Listen to the entire interview because he just has really great stories, and he's totally cool with speaking the truth. So if you do have any thoughts or feedback, please send it to us through social media. Our accounts are all at golfsub70. Here is the interview with Ken Green.
Well, we would like to welcome five-time PGA Tour winner, Ryder Cup member, Ken Green to the podcast. Ken, thank you very much for your time today in doing this. I really appreciate it.
Hey, Jason, how are you? Anytime, bub.
So my first question is, where did you grow up? How did you get involved in golf, and how did you start playing?
Wow, well, it was kind of unique, for sure, because my mom and dad moved to Honduras basically to try to save their marriage. My father was a terrible drinker, and the only options I had in Honduras as an 11-year-old were soccer, which, as you can imagine, back in 1970, we were 69, we never even heard of the damn sport, much less knew what it was, and or golf, because they wouldn't let me play basketball or baseball because I was American. So golf became my new passion.
And at what age did you start playing where the potential really started to show that you had the talent and you had the ability to be a top-level amateur player?
Well, the first day I touched the club, obviously.
Yeah, that goes without saying, of course, but yeah. Even beyond the first day.
You know, it's hard to say. I mean, you know, I knew for sure when I was probably 14 or 15 that golf was going to be my world. Now, I had no clue whether I was going to be good enough. You know, I was in high school, and then I went to college, and even in college, I had no clue if I was going to be, you know, good enough to make it. But, you know, if my theory was if I didn't make it on the PGA Tour, you know, then I would be in golf in one form or another. So, I mean, I guess, you know, again, you can almost say from the beginning, because I fell in love with it, so that was going to be my goal, was to be in golf forever.
As a follow-up, was there actually a lot of golf courses in Honduras, or is it a fairly popular game in that, you know, that region?
No. There was a 1 9-hole golf course in the country, and it was an absolute dump. But it was perfect for me.
Yeah, start off playing, and you're close enough to it, so what's the odds?
Yeah, I mean, it's actually perfect for me, because, you know, when you're 11 years old, you don't hit it very far. You know, I mean, every hole today would, you know, there's three holes that would be drivable. But when you're 11, it's ideal. You know, The hardest thing when you first start playing the game of golf is not being able to score very well. And part of the reason that there's not enough kids playing today is because they haven't figured out a way to entice the kids into understanding that a 7 is a good score. And, you know, without changing the subject too much, I really think par needs to be changed for kids, because they understand par, bogey, birdie, doubles. And when they're making 7s, you know, on every hole when you first start playing, it gets a little discouraging. But if they're told par is 7, you know, and they, you know, at the end of the day, you shot 5 over or 10 over, and then you keep getting better and better, I think you got a better chance of keeping kids in the game.
I agree with you exactly, or I agree with you with that point about the score. And also, too, having a golf course like I grew up on, you can actually run the ball up on every – I grew up on a little 9-holer, and you could run up every shot. So even if you didn't hit it far as a kid, you could still kind of bunt it up there. And it was, you know, it was relatively simple, and it kept the game fun. And as you got a little bit better, you could, you know, actually make a par or two every now and then. It didn't have to carry, you know, not a lot of forced carries. So I think those kind of little golf courses are great to grow up on.
Oh, they're ideal.
So then you start playing golf in college, community college. Then you went to the University of Florida, and I was wondering how that experience was, and who was on your team at that point. Was Kelkovecki and that group on your team at Florida?
Yeah, we actually had a really good team. Kalk was on the team, and you know, I think at one time we had all 6 of our starters on tour. I mean, Kalk and I are the only ones that kind of lasted. You know, Terry Anton, Larry Rinker, Rick Pearson, you know, they were all on and got on tour, but never didn't stay on tour, so to speak. But it was, you know, college is college. It's different than it is now. You know, when I talk to some of my friends' sons that go there, and they're doing this and they're doing that, and they're, you know, you're being recruited when you're in sophomore now. It's like, you know, it's a little bit of a mystery as to how much they do, plus how much the coaches do. You know, when we played, the coach never told us how to play or never worked with our swing or anything like that. Whereas today, you know, they have routines for them. You know, you got to be in the gym from X to X, then you got to be on the range from X to X, and then they also help them with their golf swing, and sometimes that's good. But I'm a believer that most of the time it's probably not so good.
And then I'm assuming in your generation it was way more low key, correct? The coach just said, "Hey, you guys go play. I know what you're doing." There was no workout schedule or gym time from that generation.
Oh God, no! If somebody had said to us, "Go to the gym," we'd have played basketball. I mean, that's all we would have done. I mean, it just wasn't of that era. And you got to remember that, you know, people have this impression that there's better athletes today than there were back then. And my view is the complete opposite, but it didn't matter how strong you were physically when you were hitting persimmon woods and the older golf ball. I mean, you could have been Hercules himself. If you didn't have a golf swing, you were not going to play good golf. Whereas today it's a little different because of the equipment has evolved so much. Physical strength can actually create club head speed. And you don't, you know, the sweet spots are, I don't know the exact number, but they're probably 3 times bigger than they used to be. So that gives you a lot of room for error. So guys are swinging like, you know, mad cows. And it's not that the players of the 60s or 70s or even, you know, my era couldn't swing that fast physically. It's just that you wouldn't have played professional golf if you swung that fast.
No, I'm totally with you. I'm 44 years old, and I grew up still as a kid playing that small headed wooden driver, and, you know, blade irons were my first set even as a kid. And, you know, you were taught, the way you were taught back then was totally different, of nice and easy, hit a little low draw, take the spin off and let it, you know, and let it maximize distance that direction. So I've started off with the same equipment you guys were on. It's a huge difference from what you can do with it now.
Oh, it's massive. And you know, like you're saying, the part of the fall of today's golf courses is we grew up in courses where the ball rolled, you know, and if there wasn't a bunker, you could bounce it up. And whereas now there's so many of the courses that are going into this green world, and they're making the golf courses so soft, which in reality makes it easier for the good player and harder for the average player, which is exactly what the opposite of what we need to do to get people into the game of golf, because we're losing people left and right. You know, when your era might very well be the last era of a decent amount of golfers. But in 20 years, when, you know, say I'm dead and gone and all these other guys are barely playing, there's going to be half our golf courses are going to be gone.
Well, since I'm in the golf business, let's hope that doesn't quite happen yet. I've hopefully got a good 20-year run left in me. So you turn pro, and then did you have to go to Q school in that direction to get on the tour, or did you qualify your way in like Kalk did where Bobby Clampett did. I interviewed him where he said he didn't have to do it. Kalk had to go to Q school. They had two segments then. How did you get your way onto the PGA Tour, and sort of how did you find your way between the 82, 83, 84 season, sort of getting used to being a seasoned touring pro and being out there with those guys?
Well, you know, back then there was very few options to hone your game in between Q schools. And, you know, there was a mini tour in Orlando, so basically that's where we played. But it was when I finally got through, I think it took me three times, when I finally got through the Q school, we still had Monday qualifying. That was the last year, and 82 was the last year of Monday qualifying. For viewers that may not know what that is you got the rights to play the PGA Tour, and then all that got you was the ability to qualify on Monday. And depending on the tournament, you might have as little as five spots available for, you know, 90 guys, or you might have as many as 25 spots available. And it would all depend on the exempt players, how many of them played, and then who made the cut the previous week, because it was, if you made a cut, you got automatically got in the next tournament. So it was, you know, I mean, in a way, I'm very glad I got to see that, because it was a different style of golf, or in a different way of having to perform, where you learned how to play under the gun, because it was one round period to get to the tournament. And I really think that probably helped a lot of us, whereas, you know, today it's totally different, where they basically send you to the web.com, you know, unless you're a, quote, you know, Jordan Spieth or a Tiger who is, you know, ahead of everybody, who can make enough money in seven or eight events, then they can get on the PGA Tour. Everyone else is basically sent to the minor league tour, which is a, quote, the web.com tour. So it's evolved quite a bit.
So in 1985, you get your first victory at the Buick Open. What got you over that hurdle, and what's your thoughts when you win your first PGA Tour event? Is it relief? Is it just elation? Sort of looking back, what's your thoughts on that?
Elation would definitely fall in there. Relief, I don't know, because I was still, you know, again, because, you know, we're still hitting Persimmon and all that, it's a learning process out there. You know, even guys like, you know, Bobby Clampett, who is an absolute stud muffin, and Hale Sutton and O'Meara and John Cook, and all these guys that were like, oh my God, what chance do I have against Pete and these guys? You know, you really learned. And each year you just kept getting better. And, you know, finally, you know, the Buick comes along, and it was literally my first chance to actually win a golf tournament. And as luck would have it, everything went my way. And you know, I've been very fortunate, you know, that when I was in the hunt, I can honestly say I never, you know, panicked, so to speak. And, you know, why that is, I don't know. I mean, it could be, you know, life's lessons, or it could just be some people have a different character. I mean, you know, when you look at why some guys haven't won as much as they've won, you shake your head, because you're going like, God, this guy's way too good not to have won more. Or then you look at the Corey Pavins of the world, who had literally just figures out how to get it around and good enough to beat you. It's the mystery of golf.
And then from 85 to 89, you're in the prime of your career. There's four of the wins on the PGA Tour in that stretch. Looking back, what was the strength of your game, and how did you perform at that level for that extended period of time?
Well, as wacky as this might sound, I think my strength was and also my weakness. And then I was, oh man, I was so dumb. I was so aggressive. It just didn't dawn on me that you couldn't go for all the pins and you couldn't be aggressive with par fives. And you know, not that I was a bomber of the ball. I was a tad longer than most, but it just, I don't know what it was, but during that stretch when I did win on the tour and then I won four others overseas and stuff. And it was, my short game has always been really good. I've got really good hands. So, you know, that obviously is huge for a professional golfer, you know, being able to up and down it a lot. But it was just, I think just confidence, you know, each year I felt like I was getting better and better and better, you know, and it was fun. You know, I would have really loved to see how much better I could have gotten if I hadn't lost my marbles. But, you know, that's part of life too. So you just got to deal with it.
And in 89, you get on the Ryder Cup team. It's on foreign soil. How excited were you to be on that team? Your record was solid, 2-2-0. And what's that pressure like versus, say, a normal tour event?
Yeah, that was so much fun. And what I try to explain to people is usually you start feeling the pressure on a regular tournament. You know, the last nine holes, you start feeling like, all right, this is it. You're either going to play these nine holes well and win, or you're going to, you know, suck eggs and lose. But at the Ryder Cup, the Friday matches felt like that. You know, the Saturday matches felt like that, and the Sunday matches felt like that. So it was, to me, it was like the absolute heaven, because every day was that intense pressure. And it was absolutely, I couldn't have had a better time. It was, you know, Calc and I played and we wiped out our guys in the alternate shot. You know, and I think it's because we both were so similar that we didn't worry about screwing each other up. You know, we were both aggressive. We both banged our putts. We didn't care if we messed up, you know, whereas sometimes, I don't know how often you play alternate shot, but sometimes you're worried so much about what you're going to leave your partner that you don't play your own golf. And, you know, Calc and I just, I mean, when I say we buried him. It wasn't even close.
Well, your games are so similar, Calc and you, it makes sense why you guys would be teammates out there, in the sense that you guys are going to fire at the pins. Your short games were both, like I said, fantastic. So, okay,
right.
if you miss a pin, you know your partner can get that ball up and down. And I'm assuming that just gives you a sense of freedom, even in the Ryder Cup, to play aggressively,
right,
especially
absolutely.
When Calc is your partner.
Yeah. Well, I mean, ask any pro, when they're putting really well, they're going to be more aggressive because, you know, they say, all right, I'm putting well, so if I miss it, I can chip up to 6-7 feet and make it. Whereas if you're putting poorly, you put more pressure on your irons. And it's the same thing with alternate shot. If you're thinking more about what not to do and where not to put your partner and worried about, you know, putting him in the garbage can, then you're not going to play your normal game. I mean, you can still lose, but you might as well lose playing your game. And, you know, that's what, you know, there was like that week, there was zero doubt who we were going to be paired with. I mean, it was just a no-brainer. I mean, you know, Calc and I were obviously best buds, but besides being best friends, our games were just so similar.
And speaking, looks like, you know, like the captain that you had, Raymond Floyd, at that time, recognized that and put you guys together. And how was Raymond as a captain, and in your opinion, what makes or what attributes does a good captain in the Ryder Cup bring to the table or have to have to help that team get over the finish line?
The captaincy has evolved so much. You know, when we played, there was one captain. You know, now there's four or five. It's a bigger difference now in the sense that the biggest decision a captain has to make, and obviously this is just my opinion, but is to analyze how you're going to set up the golf course and how you're going to set up the pins. You know, I don't know, you know, if I were captain, I would make sure I had a stat sheet up the kazoo of where my players missed the ball. And if there was a pattern where they more of a missed it in the left rough than the right rough, then I'm damn well going to cut the left rough down a little lower. And I'm going to make sure that the pins are more on the right side than on the left side. you know, those, that's in my, you know, in my view, is the only thing that a captain can do that can make a difference. The rest is on the players. You know, when the players threw Tom Watson under the bus, I don't know, what was it like? I don't even remember what year, 13 or something like that. You know, when they were over there and Nicholson and someone, they just threw Tom under the bus. And it is a total crock because it's on the players. These aren't like high school players that we're telling, okay, you're playing for our country. These are a top players that the U.S. has to offer. You know, and if they screw up, they have to take the responsibility. And, you know, and I'm not a huge fan of Tom Watson, but he was treated so bad that week. And I don't care what he said to everybody. It's still on you. I mean, if you can't get up to play for the United States in the Ryder Cup with the intensity that it has, then you shouldn't be playing professional golf. And when you lose, you gotta suck it up and say, we screwed up. We're going to do better. And, you know, the hardest thing to do is blame yourself in any event, especially a team event. And, you know, this is why my view that we've had such a skid for so long is because they just kind of kept blaming everybody else and everything else instead of just saying, you know what, we just sucked.
Well, also during that period of time, you're obviously in all of the major championships with the wins that you had. What was your favorite major to play in? Which one, looking back, best suited your game? And just give us your views of all the major championships, all four of them, and your thoughts on kind of each one of them, which one you like the most, or thoughts on them.
Well, I do honestly believe that the Players' Championship should be a major. It's insane that it's not. I mean, when you look at the so-called criteria for what is a major and what isn't, it's like it literally has the best field all year. So how can that not be a major? It's played at a phenomenal golf course. And obviously it has a history now, kind of like of Augusta. And if you want, I'll give you my version as to why it's not considered a major. If you go back in the early 80s, and again, this is when I was brand new on tour, the idea of TPC Golf was just starting to be pushed by Dean Beeman. And TPC Jacksonville was being built. There was a huge, and I mean a huge, disagreement between Jack Palmer and Tom Watson and a couple of the other big guns, you know, the powers of the tour, so to speak, about whether the tour should be getting into golf course, you know, real estate, you know, venues that they, Jack and those guys believed that we were a golf tour and should only be a golf tour. And Beeman believed that we needed to branch out in order to improve our history and our future, so to speak. So there was a huge players meeting, and Beeman was about to be fired. All the players were pretty much going to fire him. And I'll give Dean a lot of credit for this because I'm not a Dean fan. He outmaneuvered him, and he came back. He came, you know, he printed up a nice brochure, explained all the numbers, said, this is why we need to do this. This is why it's going to be good for golf, and just absolutely embarrassed Jack, Arnold, and Tom. Now, at that same time, if you look back at the history, the TPC was just about to be given the fifth major, boom, you know, and label, so to speak. And that, It was. They were just waiting for Jack and Arnold and Tom's final approval of, yes, we need to count this as a major. And I honestly believe that the only reason it didn't get past that last step of being considered a major was because of the embarrassment that Jack and Arnold and those guys felt when they lost that battle to Beeman. They were not about to give him credit for creating a major, because it was also his idea to create the Tournament Players Championship. And so they walked it back. And that's, I mean, it's inexcusable for that tournament not to be a major. And, you know, so that, I didn't mean to branch off on the quote on the fifth major, but I just thought I'd give you my
No, it's fascinating. I mean, you were out there during that period of time, right? Because, I mean, if there's another tournament that's ever kind of thrown in that arena of back and forth, that's it, right? I mean, it's the biggest event outside of one, so it's an interesting backdrop to it.
It's crazy. But now, you know, if someone says, okay, it's God's law, we can only have four majors, then what do you do? You know, if I had to kick one of the majors out, I would, believe it or not, I would kick out the Masters. I love Augusta. You know, how can you not? You watch Augusta as a kid, and you're growing it, you know, and you're playing it. But when you really look at the big picture, Augusta is a very weak field. You know, you're never going to get, you know, the, and I hate to use the word, shocked winner or the fluke winner, so to speak, because he's never there. John Daly would never, you know, wouldn't have come out of nowhere and won the 91 PGA at Augusta because he wouldn't have been in Augusta, you know, or anybody else who comes out of nowhere, you know, whether it's a Michael Campbell who won the U.S. Open or, you know, all these players that have won majors that people are like, whoa, where'd he come from? You know, and sometimes they go on to have great careers and sometimes they were just had that great week. But it's, that being said, I think you'd be a fool not to say because of the history of Augusta, you know, majority of players would probably tell you they'd rather win the Masters. Myself, I'd rather win a U.S. Open because I'm kind of a loyal nut to my country. But, you know, to me, that's the best. But the thing about a U.S. Open versus the Masters or even a PGA is that besides the smaller fields at Augusta, Augusta fits a certain style player. Whereas the U.S. Open can kind of, any kind of player can win a U.S. Open. You know, it can be a shorter Curtis Strange type player, or it can be the Jack Nicklaus's or Tiger Woods, you know, Rory McIlroy's of the world that just dominate a U.S. Open. And, you know, that's the greatness of the U.S. Open, kind of like a TPC where it too has had Fred Funk's win or Tiger wins, you know. And to me, that's the great sign of a great tournament where all the players are capable of winning. It's just a question of who plays best. Whereas at Augusta, there's only a few. You're not going to get too many rare, you know, whoa, you know, where'd he come from? I'm trying to think of somebody, Trevor Immelman. You know, no one would have ever picked Trevor Immelman to win Augusta. But, you know, if I were to go to the next level, I got to say the British Open, just because it is such, have you ever played over there?
I played in Southern England, not in Scotland, but it was still amazing to go over and just play Royal St. George's and see it. It's my favorite major championship. I just love the history of it.
Oh, I had told people, my friends and any of your viewers are out there, if you love golf and you haven't gone over there, you need to save your money and go because it is, you know, Scotland and Ireland are just those golf courses, you know, besides the fact that that's where, you know, the game of golf was born, it's just a different game and it is so fun and so aggravating and, you know, kind of what golf is all about, you know. That's what golf is, fun, aggravating. You know, one minute you're ready to bury the clubs into the ocean, and the next minute you're on a high. But it's, you know, over there, it's just, you have to play it. I mean, I would tell you this, if their weather wasn't so bad, I would move there because I would love to play those golf courses on a daily basis.
Well, also from your generation, and I was talking to Kelkovecki on this, there was a lot of Tuesday gambling games to keep you guys, you know, sharp on the PGA Tour. So my question is there any great stories from a Tuesday money game on tour, and what's the most money you've ever won or lost in one of these games?
Well, you know, the funny thing is, and this is the nature of gamblers, I can't tell you the most I won. Yeah, and obviously, I honestly believe I've won more than I've lost, but I really don't know. But what I remember the most were the two beatdowns. it was one year at TPC. It was Calc and I against Paul Azinger and Blaine McAllister. And back then I think we were playing $100. You could press when the ball's in the air, one down autos, you know, all that kind of stuff. And we finished starting on 12. We finished birdie, eagle, birdie, and we lost.
How did they shoot on it?
Yeah, it was unbelievable. It was Azinger, you know, we pretty much were down to everything. You know, it was $1,500 is what we ended up losing. I think Kalkic stiffed it to about a foot on 18 at TPC Sawgrass. And trust me, back then, it was much harder than it is now. And Azinger holed it out. Oh, I could have thrown his ass in the water. Oh, I'm so pissed. So that was you know, one beating. And the biggest beating was, and Calc might have told you this one, Hawaii and Kapalua.
No, I didn't hear this one. Oh, he said he punished his putter in Kapalua.
Now, again, only people that are old enough are going to understand, you know, today's Bermuda grass putts so well, it's scary how good the grass is now. But back in my era, putting on Bermuda was the hardest thing on the planet. If you didn't grow up on Bermuda grass, understanding that the ball can actually break uphill because the grain is like a Brillo and it actually moves uphill, you know, you grow up in Connecticut, you are not going to get this. So back then, it was Kapalua Invitational. You know, now it's the Tournament of Champions. And there was six of us. And I've been trying to remember the sixth. It was myself, Calc, Mike Colbert, Ben Crenshaw, and Andy Bean. And I cannot for the life. I think it might have been Fulton Allen. We tee off at 6:30 in the morning, and we 4 hours later we played 36 holes, and I had to write Andy Bean a check for $3,000. He made everything on this stuff. I don't understand it. I'm actually going to see Andy Saturday with Matt Adams, and I'm going to rag him something fierce for that, because he grew up in Florida, and he just understood how to be able to play, and not only play on putting, you also had to understand that, you know, when it was downwind, down grain, how much you had to play for the ball to bounce, you know, and that just wasn't in my head. You know, I was used to, you know, slopey greens from, you know, the north, so you could play it right or left. But I couldn't understand when the grass was growing into the grain and you're hitting a 7-iron, the ball's going to stop on a dime. And if it's down grain, you got to play two big hops. And it's like, huh? And it just, you know, how does Tom Watson never win in the state of Florida? I mean, he's one of the best players, you know, top 10 players probably of all time. And he has never won in the state of Florida. How do you figure that? That's how hard it was to putt on this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in the Midwest, and anytime you put me on grainy Bermuda, I'm in trouble. I mean, I'm not a professional golfer or anything, but it's hard to make that switch. So,
yeah.
And by the way, that group, if let's assume Fulton Allen was in that group, I would have paid good money to watch those six players play a competitive round of golf. Great. There's some characters in that one.
Yeah, it was great. But I did get my revenge, because we went in, and, you know, like I said, we finished, it was only 10:30. We go have a bite to eat, and I have a good friend of mine who's caddying for me, and we start talking about tennis, and Annie says, well, he can play tennis, and I'm like, all right, let's go. We're going to play tennis, and I'm going to try to get some of my money back. So he has this caddy, and we go out and play, and I got half my money back, but the best thing was that I got to drop the big guy down. Now, what he didn't know back then was I'm a little aggressive on the tennis court. We play what we call skins, you know, which is basically trying to hit the guy. And I managed to get him in the, let's say, I'll put it in radio words, the softer spot of a man. And it was so funny to watch him get whacked right there. Now, obviously, I wasn't trying to hit him there. And he just got it. And I can still remember to this day, it was the old two hands down there, and he just fell over. He just dropped. Oh, the classic.
Well, that might have been worth the $1,500 loss.
Just absolutely it was. I'm telling you, I'm not going to say, this was literally 30-some-odd years ago. And I can still remember the two hands going there and then him just dropping.
Well, also, you were known as a rebel on tour a little bit, and there's a couple stories I read about that I just have to ask, of the beer with Arnie at Augusta and then sneaking your buddy into the Masters in the trunk of a car. I have to ask him those two.
Okay. Well, the first one, I'll do it in quote in order. It was 89, and for people who don't know, they give you family passes. So I had 8 family passes sent to the house. And I played the week before, and they let you buy up to 8 passes for friends at the tournament. So my wife was going to bring the 8 family passes, and I was just going to buy the 8 when I got there. I got there earlier, and she wasn't going to get there until Tuesday night. Somehow, we end up having some sort of fight, and I couldn't tell you what it was about, but all I know is now she decides she's not coming to the Masters. Fine, don't come to the Masters, whatever. Just send up the tickets, and that's that. She refused to send up the tickets. I'm like, oh, Ellen, come on, half your family's going to be here. You know, this is half your family and half my friends. Nope, nobody could talk her into it. No one in her family, that's just who she was. So I'm, you know, Wednesday's here, and I'm like, oh, man, we are screwed. So now I decide I'm going to go into Hoard's office. Now, he and I don't necessarily see eye to eye, but I think man to man, I'm going to go in there and explain to him the real, honest truth. I'm going to tell him exactly what happened. I'm not going to make up some story, figuring that every man who's had a wife understands that sometimes these things happen. So I go in there, I lay out the story. He looks at me, and he goes, "You need to get better control of your wife." No. So I'm like, okay, all right. So I was stunned. I don't know what made me think of this, but I really thought he was going to understand and say, okay, I'll let you buy 8 more. So now I've got 16 people there, and I only got 8 passes. So I end up having to bring everybody in, you know, through my car. You know, we go in, I drop off 4, and then I go back out, pick up some more, you know, and we do the bus rotation, so to speak. And now I give the 8 youngest the no pass, figuring that they're going to be the quickest of feet to move around the guards. And if anybody asks them where their pass is, you know, that kind of stuff. Well, as it turns out, her brother gets caught. Well, he panics and he tells him he's with Ken Green. So now it gets back to Hoard, and Hoard knows that I'm sneaking people in because he knows I don't have the tickets. So the next day, we have to figure out a new plan. So we bring the first 4 in, and they decide they're going to search the car. And I'm like, well, why are we searching the car? What's this all about? You know, well, we heard you were sneaking people. I'm like, no, that's crazy. So, you know, I go back out. Now, when I bring the people back, you know, I only have so many passes. So now we have people under a blanket by our feet in the back, and then we have a few others hanging out with the clubs, and they didn't notice it, and they didn't say. So we pulled this off for the next 3 days, because as it turned out, I made the cut. So we went through this process for the next 3 days, but it was it turned out it was my best Master Stew on top of it, but it was
and a great story.
Yeah, no, I mean, it was a classic. So now we fast forward to 97. And that was my last Masters. The day before we teed off, my friends were outside playing hoops at the house we rented. So I went out just to watch them, because I obviously wouldn't even think about playing basketball the night before I'm playing the Masters. Well, the ball rolls under the car. So I reach under to grab it, and another friend of mine comes out of the house. And as I'm reaching under, you know, I'm leaning under and reaching, he kind of bumps me in the butt, you know, just kiddingly. Well, just as I was reaching for the ball, he did that, and my left thumb cracked up against the ball and broke. So I shoot 87, and I'm like, all right, I'm gonna withdraw. This is kind of stupid, you know. I just shot 87, you know, and then I found out I was paired with Arnold Palmer. Now, because of our age difference, I had never got. Had the opportunity to play a round of golf with Arnold. And, you know, obviously he was, you know, he's the king, you know, I mean, he is who he is.
Absolutely.
And so I said, all right, I'm going to play. And I can honestly tell you it was one of the best days I've ever had on the golf course. Knowing obviously that you're not going to make the cut. And he was so nice to play with, you know, and he told me so many stories and it was just a blast. And then after I put it out on 14, I had a friend of mine go get me a beer because I figured this is going to be my only chance ever to have a beer with Arnold Palmer. I mean, you know, this is the king. I mean, my God. And so, you know, he got the beer, and then I ran up and caught Palmer in the 15th fairway. I said, Arn, I got to tell you, man, this has been a blast. I love you to death, and I want to have a beer with you, so this is my beer. And he looked at me and goes, you should have brought me one. And I said, well, I would never do such a thing. And, you know, so when we got through, you know, the media being the media, they know that I kind of just tell it how it is. And so I ended up telling that story, and of course I got fined for having the beer and all that fun stuff, but it was more than worth it.
Well, absolutely. A beer with Arnie, that's another great story. So,
oh, absolutely.
We had to go explore that one. So I'm going to give you some names from players from your era. And if you can just give me your quick thoughts on these players and just kind of what comes to your mind, sort of like a
real thoughts, or do I got to be politically correct?
You can say whatever you want to say. This is your form.
Okay, good. All right.
Payne Stewart.
I love Payne. We played so many practice rounds together, and it was, you know, in the beginning he was a little, you know, like most of us, we were young, kind of stupid, a little cocky, didn't always handle things the right way, but Payne had a heart of gold, and he's just a good man.
Paul Azinger.
Another guy that I used to play the practice rounds with. I love Zinger to death. He was hopefully you won't be hearing this. He so much wanted to be part of, like, Falk and I kind of had free run, you know. Our wives didn't travel with us much, and and his wife did. And I can't tell you how many times we'd be out hanging with Paul, goofing around, throwing footballs or something, and his wife would come out the door and give him the old, "Paul, Paul," and he'd look at us and goes, "Ah, shit."
He got called back home. Right?
He got called back into. But Paul, you know, he loved it. He loved the Tuesday games. And I love Paul.
Fred Couples.
Fred played a decent amount of Tuesday games. I'm going to go a little off the world here. I'm a little baffled as to why the world was so in love with Fred, because he wasn't good with people. You know, and I don't know whether it was just, you know, having Jim Nance and CBS helped, because, you know, they were best friends, but, you know, he didn't treat people. He's much better now. He's finally figured out that it's good to be good to people. You know, it's a shame he didn't love golf, because that boy had some serious talent, man. And he could have really, you know, every era has those players that people go, wow. If he had the dedication that, or the love that, you know, a Jack or a Watson or a Phil, Tiger, you know, he could have been that good.
I can tell you from a fan's perspective, and growing up and watching him and loving Freddie Couples' game, I think it was how effortlessly he could play. Just that swing, the power, it just looked like it was given to him from the heavens, how easy he could make it look at time. It was fun to watch.
That the tempo was amazing that he had. You know, that just blah. It was like it kind of reminds me of the first person that I saw swing like that, that was just, did he even swing, was Gene Littler. And then, you know, Freddie has that. Ernie Els kind of has it. You know, like they don't even look like they're swinging.
Yeah, it looked effortless. He was fun to watch, of just that kind of carefree attitude. Well, I got two more here for you. Seve Ballesteros.
Oh, Seb. he was just kind of a dick. Just the only way to put it. You know, I mean, a great golfer. So Sevy the golfer and Sevy the person. Sevy the golfer was phenomenal. The only guy that I've ever seen that I might say had better hands than me. But I'll never understand why he had to play all the games, the intimidation games and, you know, the noises and the move-in. And I'm guessing it's from the caddy days and, you know, growing up poor and playing all the games you do with your friends, you know, like you might, you know, goof around with your friends and do that kind of stuff. But he brought it to the next level. And, you know, he and I had a button of heads in the 89 Masters. It was the last day. And we were in contention, but we needed a good round. You know, I think we were like the fourth, the last group or something like that. And he shoots 31 on the front. Just plays flawlessly. I mean, it was just a perfect nine holes of golf. And on 10, he overcooks it and pulls it into the trees at the Masters, we're talking. And so I was curious as to whether he was going to have a shot or not. And so I walk down into the trees, and I get there, and he's in a little bit of a rut. So there's no way he can get a 2 or 3 iron up over this rut and, you know, up by the green. So I just walk to my ball, and all of a sudden I look back, and, you know, he's probably 80 yards behind me, 100 yards, and he's taking a drop. And I'm like, oh, what the hell is that all about? There's no, you know, there was nothing there. So I go wandering back up this hill because I want to know what's going on. So at Augusta, they have a rules official on every hole. So the official tells me that, he says, well, here at Augusta, we have a rule of crowd damage. And if we deem that the lie has been altered based on crowd damage, we give them a drop. So I'm giving Sevy a drop. And I'm like, no way, that's bull. That's not crowd damage. That's just a rut. And so I said, I want another opinion, which, you know, obviously was my right. And so we're just standing there, and Sevy looks at me, and he goes, Ken, you can leave. You know, I'm not going to cheat. And I said, well, I'm not so sure about that. I'm going to wait. And, you know, of course, the crowd wooed and awed and all that kind of stuff. And then the head official that year was Michael, I think his name is Balinick, you know, the RNA president. And he gets within probably 15 feet and already knew what it was. He said, put the ball back. And so Sevy had to punch out by me, and he never got it back. So he, you know, we both, I think, finished tied for 10th, but it was just, Sevy was Sevy, you know, he used his charisma sometimes to get the better drops, so to speak. Or, you know, he would use intimidation on players, and it's just who he was. I mean, it's, you know, but it's not something that I think that, you know, it's just not something that I like. It's unfortunate that he passed from with the brain tumor, and he would have been great for senior golf, or, you know, even European senior golf, because everybody loves Sevy. He is who he was. But life can be rough at times.
My last one, and I don't know how much you played with him, but I find his life fascinating, is Tom Weisskopf, for the talent and the look of that golf swing. But I don't know how much in the early 80s you played with him, but if you did, I'd love your take on him.
I actually have played a few rounds with Tom, and I actually had a few drinking rounds with Tom too. So I probably learned more about Tom in our drinking rounds than I did our golf rounds. You know, Tom Weisskopf was another kind of like a Fred Couples. You know, he had that smooth, lazy, didn't look like he was swinging, but he fell in that same boat as Freddie, in that I don't think he loved the game enough, or was just, you know, everyone thought for sure he was going to be the next Nicklaus, you know, because the one thing the media is always looking for is the next Nick, you know, the next Nicklaus. And it, he just, I guess he just wasn't able to deal with that. And instead of embracing it, he kind of turned away from it. And so I don't think he ever reached, you know, he's a player that never even came close to reaching his potential. You know, if you look at Weisskopf or Couples, or, you know, Greg Norman, I think is the biggest talent that never accomplished what he should have with his skills.
So let's talk about the current state of golf. Who do you like to watch today, and what's your impression of golf being played in this era versus, you know, the era you were in your prime in, say, 30 years ago?
Well, the couple things that pop up in my mind is right now on the PGA Tour is a great time. You know, golf in general might not be, but the PGA Tour has a fabulous group of young men. You know, whether you want to count DJ as a young man at, what is he, 32, or Rory, he was getting close to 30. But, you know, then you got Fowler, and you got, you know, Spieth and Jason Day, and then you got Thomas. You know, you got this new kid, Rahm. I mean, think about it. For the next 15, maybe 20 years, you're going to have these guys beating on each other, which is going to be great for the PGA Tour. And the thing that they are now that our era wasn't, and I think this is strictly based on financial security, is they're friendly with each other. You know, they genuinely like each other. You know, if you look back on clips of the 70s and 80s and 90s and even maybe the early 2000s, you know, when guys made putts and won tournaments, whoever they were beating wasn't happy. You know, whereas now they're genuinely happy, you know, that their guy did it, you know, their friend did it. And, you know, that's, you know, hats off to them, you know. But, again, I don't know what it is. Is it just their true feelings for each other, or is the fact that, you know, money's not a big deal anymore? You know, they've already got millions and millions, whereas in those eras of, you know, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, you didn't have money. So it was like you were losing money when you got boned out of an event like that. So I think they're in great position.
I was going back and forth with Curtis Strange on Twitter, and he was commenting on a playoff, and I just can't, for example, see him and like Lanny Watkins being all friendly, you know, in 1985 during a playoff. I just can't see that. He laughed about it. He's like, there's no chance we wouldn't have even looked or talked to each other.
No, I guess I'm a firm believer that you have to be who you are. You know, Curtis was Curtis. Curtis wouldn't have talked to his mother, you know, and, you know, but that's what these guys are now. And so, they can go down, you know, while they're playing off. And it really wouldn't matter if it's the Masters or it's, you know, the Hartford Open. And they'll sit there and chit-chat with each other. And there's no way. I've only been in a couple of playoffs, and one was with Sandy Lyle, and I don't think we got within 15 feet of each other until we shook hands. And the other was with Seve and Norman. And there wasn't any, you know, you had a better chance of getting a knife in your back than you did saying good shot. you just didn't do it then.
Well, the other question I have is, if you can imagine this, the PGA Tour makes you the commissioner for one day. What one rule would you change for professional golf?
Well, the one casual rule is I would allow shorts. But the big rule was I would make sure that we do more for charity. We don't do enough for charity. As good as our organization is versus some of the other sports, you know, at one time we gave away more money to charity than all the major sports combined. I think that's since changed. But, I mean, that's how good we are for golf. But I would like to see us do more for charity.
So do you think in professional golf there should be a separate set of rules just for professional golfers at the top level versus like myself, who's an amateur player? Or do you like the fact that everyone plays under one set of rules and it's unique to the game?
You know, I used to, but I can't say that anymore. I mean, the technology has evolved so much that it's the person who's getting the most benefit are the better players. And we can't keep changing golf courses to benefit, you know, less than 1% of the players. So I really do think that we have to make some changes to the rules. Nothing crazy, but enough where we can start bringing back, you know, shot making and golf. You know, it sounds like you're being, you know, an old goat from the past, but, you know, there's not one player in the last 20 years that anyone has talked about being as one of the best ball strikers that ever played the game. And how can that be possible with today's technology? I mean, as good as the equipment is now, and especially the ball, Ben Hogan would be laughing at these guys today. I mean, Johnny Miller, and I don't, well, you're 44, so you probably saw some of it. It was insane how close he kept hitting it when he was on. I mean, these guys would be knocking pins down left and right today. And you never see a guy today just knock the pin down all day long. You know, and it's when they're shooting 59, you know, it's because they're making these 30, 40 footers now that, you know, obviously when greens were bumpy and spike marked and all that, they were hard to do. But it just, their distance control with their max speed is so inconsistent that I think it's really hard for today's player to have rounds like where you hit 14 shots inside 15 feet all day long. I mean, I can't tell you, I mean, as crappy a ball striker as I was when I was on, I would have 12 putts from 15 feet and in without even blinking. And that's lost today. It's just, you know, it's a different era, and I can't blame the players. You're born when you're born. But I would like to see some golf being brought back instead of just whack, smack, and go.
If you could take three current PGA Tour players or Champions Tour players, doesn't matter which tour, out for a day on the golf course with a fun money game and some drinks and dinner afterwards, who are you taking and why are you taking those three guys?
Well, say we're all, quote, in our prime, you know, in our prime, I'd have to take Calc, and I have to see. And I would like to go up against Tiger and Seve.
Wow, that would be a great match.
Simply, and it wouldn't be just 18 holes of golf. And this is what Calc and I used to do all the time. When we got through with the hole, you know, we would have up and down matches. So this is what we would do, you know, with Seve and Tiger. Or I'd like to put Phil in there too, or maybe add a sixth and have a, you know, three twosome, so to speak. And, you know, because to me it's about comparing our short games. You know, the ball striking, here's the weird thing about professional golfers. When you're on, you're on. No one's any better or any worse than the other. But when it comes to chipping, and short game, that's different. You're never just on chipping. You either have it or you don't. In terms of that above everybody else level. And so I would love to see who would win that contest. You know, besides the 18 holes of golf, the 18 holes of up and down.
The best golf shot you ever hit under pressure?
Two of them pop up in my head. One was at the Ryder Cup. The last day, I'm on the 18th hole, and I played really well. I think I was 4-under for the day. Or 5-under going into that hole. And I don't know if you remember Belfry at all. The old Belfry was a three-tiered green. And Jose Maria had just hit a god-awful 2-iron. I thought for sure it was going in the water. Now, this is a three-tiered green with a bunker on the left side with water. And like I said, I thought for sure it was going in the water, but it hit the lip of the bunker. And to this day, I don't know what it hit, but it must have hit it could have hit a rock, a pebble, or sometimes it's those sticks that are used to keep the mats in. Well, it somehow hit that lip of the bunker and bounced over the bunker onto the green. I mean, it was like, are you kidding me? It's just like, what in the hell just happened? And so my shot was 209 to carry the first tier. And the first tier is a massive, probably a 5-foot dip. And it's 212 to the pin. My ball flies 209, which is just on top with a cleek. Now, this is back in the day when fairway metalwoods were just being, you know, coming into play. But it was a small-headed 5-wood. And the ball was straight up in the air. And when I tell you, I thought for sure I was going to have a tap-in. And how I'm still stunned by it now. The ball bounced straight up in the air, and instead of moving forward, it just stayed there and then rolled all the way down the hill and ended up with like a 90-footer, and which, you know, you got about a 5% chance of two-putting, which I three-putted, and we lost, and we ended up tying the thing. But I could not have executed that shot any better. The Canadian Open in 98, which I won. A lot of people may remember the 6-iron that Tiger hit out of a fairway bunker to hit onto that small little green. I hit driver and flew it onto that green and stopped it on the green. It was one of the best, what we call floaters. You know, not the bullet driver where, you know, you're trying to get the ball to run. Here
driver out of a fairway trap?
No, this was out of the fairway.
Out of the fairway. Okay. You threw me off there with Tiger out of the trap. I'm like, holy
cow. Yeah, I brought Tiger's up because some people remember that.
Yeah, that was a good shot.
The idea to pull off a floater with the driver is, you know, impressive. And then, you know, the good news is I won the tournament, so that made it even better. But those are the two shots that pop in my head right away.
What's the best golf shot you ever saw somebody else hit under pressure that you were with in that group?
Believe it or not, the one that comes to my head right out of the top of my head was Jack Nicklaus. And believe it or not, I don't know if you want to call this pressure, but I'll give you a little bit of the story. I was playing with him my first rookie year in 1982, and I qualified for my first U.S. Open. And due to a follow-up, I end up playing with Jack Nicklaus and Tom Weisskopf. And we're on the 18th hole at Pebble Beach. And Tom's over his ball, going for the green. He's got a 3-wood in his hands. And Jack whistles over and says, "Hey, Eagles for dinner." And Tom says, "Sure." And then he whacks his 3-wood, and it flies in the bunker, just misses carrying. And Jack pulls out a 1-iron. He's got 252 yards to carry to the front of the green, 262 to the hole. I'll never forget this. Now, remember, a 1-iron. This was back in 1982 when I don't know how anyone hit 1-irons, but that's what a lot of players carried. I turn to my caddy and I go, "What in God's name is he thinking about? He just saw a Weisskopf bomb a 3-wood and not carry. He's got a 1-iron in his hand." Here I am telling my caddy Jack Nicklaus doesn't know what he's doing. And I watched this shot take off. It took off like a wedge. It went straight up in the air and flew 253 yards and rolled up pin high, and he makes the putt. And the crowd, and this is a practice round, we probably had 10,000 people following us. And that's the shot. I know it wasn't, quote, to win the golf thing or anything, but that's the most memorable shot I've ever seen anybody hit. That 1-iron was just stupid.
And that's impressive, too. I mean, that's the old equipment with the old ball. One iron, ridiculous.
I mean, my 1-iron back then flew half as high as his did. I'm telling you, this thing was, you know, like today's players, they all hit it straight up in the air. But that's the equipment. But back then, Jack was the only one that could hit that shot. You know, I mean, he was the only one. And it was just, I was like, wow, good God. You know, it just, okay. welcome to the tour. You know, my first time ever with Jack Nicklaus, and I just watched him hit this 1-iron that was, you know, came down like a damn butterfly.
who had the most, we kind of talked about this earlier a little bit, kind of you gave a couple names out there, but who had just the most natural raw talent you ever played with? Just purely raw talent that you saw?
I honestly think the best player would have been Greg Norman. He was just so good at everything. And he was, you know, he played in an era when driving the golf ball was so important, and he drove it so straight and so much longer than everybody. I know he got boned out of a couple majors, but just raw physical talent, it would definitely be Greg. I think if Tiger or Phil or Watson or Jack was in his game, was in his head, their careers would have been, you know, even better than they are now.
Final question I have. What's the three best golf courses in the world, and what makes those courses so great, in your opinion?
Well, the best is Pebble Beach. And the main reason is it's located in an area where you can have different weather conditions all the time, which means you're playing a different golf course all the time. So if you were stuck on Pebble Beach the rest of your life, you're literally playing many different courses. And the other reason that I consider Pebble one of the best is that, unlike some of the harder golf courses, the Wingfoots of the world that you can never really beat up, you can win the battle at Pebble. You can go out and shoot a low round, you know, if the weather's good and you play well. So it's like the perfect woman. You know, it's Pebble hands down. Now, the second best, I'm probably going to go with TPC in Jacksonville, but I'm not going to give Pete Dye any credit, if that makes any sense. It took him 6 redos, you know. But it's still, you have to think your way around that golf course. You have to have all the shots. Like I was talking earlier, it's not favored the Curtis Strange, Fred Funk type, or the Tiger Woods, you know, Jason Day, you know, power, 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 Dustin Johnson game. You have to play golf. And those would be my two favorite courses. And then the third, which I don't know if anybody really even knows about, would probably be Quaker Ridge, just close to, right next to Wingfoot in Westchester, New York area. Just an old-style golf course that's just phenomenal.
Well, I can't thank you enough for taking your time to be on the podcast today. I truly enjoyed it, and thanks for all of your insight and information. And hopefully we can get you on again sometime and talk about golf. So thank you very much.
You got it, buddy. Have a good one.